This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. You might think that humans are the apex predator, but let's see what you think when you're about your place in the food chain, when you're walking alone on a trail, you're having your nature hike, and suddenly you see some nature, a creature that's sizing you up. It could be a bear, a cougar, a wolf, and what happens next depends on you. You know, animals only obey one law, the Darwin law of survival, but what happens when they break human laws? Acclaimed science writer Mary Roach pounced onto that question in her new book, Fuzz. And Mary Roach, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And listeners, you can join our conversation. We want to hear your questions and comments. Have you ever had a rude run-in with a wild animal? Tell us what happened. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. You could also tweet at us at TPRSource or email us at thesource@tpr.org. So, Mary, I'm walking down the nature trail. Suddenly, I see some eyeballs looking at me. And what do I do? I've heard that I should play dead.
Well, kind of depends on whose eyeballs those are, David. a raccoon or a bobcat or a fox, you know, I wouldn't worry too much. Bear or cougar, that's another scenario. Playing dead, you must be referring to that. If it's black, fight back. If it's brown, lie down, which is what people often say regarding bears. Not the best advice, partly because a lot of black bears look brown, and a lot of brown bears, like grizzlies, often look black. So they'd say that a better way to tell the difference between the two is by the length of the claws. But I'm thinking if you're close enough to be able to see that, then it's probably not going to be very helpful. So what you want to do is, first of all, assess if it's a defensive scenario. In other words, have you startled this creature while it's got cubs maybe, or it's protecting a food source? It just wants you to back off. So it's going to try to be scary. I'm talking about a bear in particular. So it may do a bluff charge. And in that case, you just want to calmly back away, sort of give the message that you're not a threat and that you get the message and you're moving away.
What about yelling, hollering, waving your arms, throwing rocks?
With a mountain lion or a cougar, yeah. I mean, very much. If it seems like this actually is real, this animal is bent on attacking, then yeah, look as big as you can, yell, have your bear spray ready, anything you can to show that you are not going to take this lightly, that you're going to fight back. So kind of trying to figure out, is this really an attack, or is this just the animals just trying to scare you off? And it's maybe a bluff charge. It's just going to come a little bit towards you and then stop. And in that case, you know, just back off. But yeah, if it's really an attack situation and it's, you know, the ears are flat, it's coming at you, then yeah, look big, make noise, for sure.
Ears are flat. That's, I saw that a couple of times in your book. That's the telltale sign that this creature thinks you're a meal.
Yeah, that's not something you want to see.
And so what happens? Okay, so we get into a scuffle. This guy's got teeth, they've got fangs, they've got claws, they've got muscle. It's just little old me. I'm not going to last very long. So I succumb to this overpowering creature. What happens after I'm dead? Who's going to come out there and try and figure out what happened?
You're going to be part of a crime scene that is, I'm using crime in quotes because obviously these are our laws. Animals can't really break the law. They're not really criminals, but anyway, the scene is taped off in a similar way to what would happen in a human on human murder. And someone, out west anyway, there's people called predator attack specialists, and they're forensics specialists, and they work for wildlife agencies, typically, you know, fish and game, fish and wildlife, and they've been certified as predator attack specialists, and they will come in and they'll secure the scene, and they will start, just as in a human on human murder, collecting evidence. The first thing they're going to do, look at the victim, and examine the injuries, the teeth marks, the claw marks, the nature of the attack to determine the species, first of all, because you don't know, you know, you got to figure out, was it a bear, was it a cougar, or was it a human? There have been cases where a cougar has been blamed for a death that was in fact a human killing, a person with an ice pick that stabbed the neck, but it was ruled a cougar killing and the murderer went free for many years. Sometimes happens the other way around, where the human is blamed and it was an animal killing. So you got to figure out who, what species, first of all, and then they're going to start collecting evidence to, like DNA, like looking at saliva on the victim. And then if they've trapped or killed an animal nearby, they're going to want to figure out if this is, if they've got the right creature.
So CSI, but yeah, it's like the CSI, C stands for yep. creature.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so are they, so is that just like a fait accompli that they're going to go out and they're going to find the animal that killed me and they're going to kill it? Is that, that always happens?
Well, they'll typically, you know, sometimes when an animal kills on a predatory attack, they may cache the body and, you know, save some grub for later and they'll come back. So they may be in the area. So if an animal is shot on scene or trapped on scene, then they'll do a DNA. They'll compare DNA of the victim with the animal to see if it is the right creature. And if they've, you know, if they've trapped the animal and the DNA doesn't match, that suspect is released, if you will. But if it is a match, yes, I'm afraid it's a capital punishment in this country for animals that kill humans. Yeah. It's considered a, you know, they're a public safety threat. So yes, the animal would be killed.
Do we know for sure that if an animal that will develop a taste for human flesh? Are we so tasty that a cougar, once they have a bite, they have to get more?
That's not something I've heard of happening here. The cougar attack fatality rates are extremely low. I mean, a decade will go by here in California where nobody's killed by a cougar, and there hasn't been a rise in those rates. One place it does seem to have happened, and I went there, is up in a region of the middle Himalaya in India, where leopards appear to have developed a taste for humans in that they are actually seeking them out as prey. I mean, mountain lions here, they mainly prey on deer, boar, small animals. We're not on the menu. And in India, though, in this particular region, something seems to have happened. And one theory put forth by the hunter who came in and killed one of these quote-unquote man-eaters, his theory was that in the flu epidemic of 1918, there were so many people dying so quickly that the typical funerary rites were... I think we have to wind more after this.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to get to the sentence. Close. All right, so we're going to figure out why these leopards started going after people up in the Himalayas. And we're going to continue our conversation with Mary Roach, talking about Fuzz and some of her other outstanding books. You know, they're just, it seems to take on these incredible topics that are intriguing, but kind of gross at the same time. And the number to call in is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. It's The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With us today, we're joined by Mary Roach. She is the author of 6 New York Times bestsellers, including Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, Spook Science Tackles the Afterlife, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void, Gulp, Adventures on the Alimentary Canal, and Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. And her newest book is Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. And that's going to be coming out tomorrow, but we got her here today. So if you want to call in, we can hear your stories about your contacts with nature, or if you read any of these other books and got some questions or comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So Mary Roach, you want to finish up that part about the leopards eating people in the Himalayas?
Sure. Yeah. So the theory I was starting to talk about, there was the theory as to why these leopards became man-eaters. In other words, why they started preying on people when that's not typically what they do, even in the other regions of India, a little bit further south, there's very few, there's scuffles between people who surprise leopards, say, you know, they're in the resting in the shade and somebody's in a tea estate and they're picking the tea leaves and they surprise the animal. There's just a little scuffle and the animal takes off. It's scared. But in this region in the Himalaya, they are preying on people and often small children. So, and how did that happen? There's one theory that in the flu pandemic, the early part of the last century, so many people were dying so quickly, they couldn't do the more customary bringing the body to the Ganges. So they sort of adopted this more expedient ritual where they would put a burning coal in the mouth rather than, you know, cremating, and sort of cast the body down the hill toward the river. So there were a lot of bodies out and about. And the thinking is, I mean, a leopard will scavenge food, and that the leopards got a taste for human meat that way. So that is the theory of Jim Corbett, the legendary leopard hunter. Fast forward to the present, I traveled with a researcher named Dipanjan Naha, who works with these communities to try to keep people safe and give them advice. He said what's happening in these villages, there's been a lot of out-migration. The man of the house is going and getting a job in the city, leaving to find work in the city because farming on these steep hills, it's difficult, it's hard to make a living. And so there's a lot of land sort of that's rewilded. There's a lot of more brush around the villages, places for the leopards to hide. The livestock isn't as closely tended, so more leopards are moving in, taking livestock, which is easier for them to catch than wild prey, which there's less and less of. And sometimes children are tending the livestock, and a child is an easy victim, you know, easy prey because they're smaller and they don't run as fast. So it's more just a crime of opportunity, was his feeling. So, and it may be a combination of those two factors. You really, you know, have to ask the leopards to know for sure.
Yeah. Let's go to James on the phone. James, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Howdy, James from San Antonio, Texas. How are y'all today?
All right.
Well, I'm giving a call because I actually do wildlife removal here in Texas, and I wanted to know what your thoughts are about, you know, even though they're not as dangerous or gruesome, about, you know, leopards and things like that, but raccoons, possums, squirrels, all sorts of things, and what your thoughts on about them. We're living in their backyard, not the other way around. What do you think about that?
All right, James, thank you for the call. Mary Roach, author of Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. I guess this would be trespassing.
This would be trespassing for sure. A little bit of theft in the case of squirrels raiding gardens and things. Trespassing, maybe a little vandalism. I have squirrels, raccoons, and possums in my backyard, and I'm in an urban area. And I learned a lot about kind of wildlife crime prevention. In other words, things that you can do to make your house less accessible to these guys, or, you know, so often they're coming for some kind of food that's left out. Like you have a cat door and you have cat food that's accessible, and so the raccoons are getting into your house. So there's a lot of crime prevention that can be done before you bring someone in to remove the animal. But the other thing is that there are now there are ways to humanely evict an animal from the attic or wherever it is. You know, there's one, you can put the one-way door in. I mean, you, James, know all about this, obviously, because you do this. But I was, you know, it was great for me to learn a little bit about ways to kind of keep these things from happening. And I actually love to put my wildlife camera out in the backyard and see the raccoons, possums, squirrels, and various other creatures that wander through at a surprising, with surprising regularity in my yard here.
So raccoons, possums, squirrels, they seem, they're okay on the the scale that we have for what's an acceptable animal, but then we get into maybe rats.
Well, sure. Rats, there's been historically situations where because of the way buildings were built and how porous they were, you know, how easy it was for animals to get in and how much food was available and or garbage wasn't well picked up. You have a situation where there's a lot of food available, you know, a sewer, for example. You can have an infestation, and obviously with rats, to some extent with raccoons, there's parts of the country where rabies is an issue. You got an infestation. You have to do something to get it under control. I mean, it's a health hazard. So that starts with, you know, clean it up, eliminate if you can the what's attracting them, and seal whatever openings that are allowing them to get in. But if it's already a major infestation, then you need help.
Some people turn to glue traps. There's a little plastic device that is like with a sticky, tacky substance, and if a rodent gets into there, they're not able to pull themselves away, and then you have a trapped animal right there. And you have to dispose of that. And there's conversations that glue traps to get rid of rodents is not an ethical process.
Yeah, I would love for glue traps to not exist anymore, because we have much more humane ways of killing rodents. I mean, a good old snap trap for a mouse, assuming that it goes in head first and doesn't, you know, get its tail caught. I mean, that is a very quick death. You know, it's a blow right to either the head or the neck. So, you know, it sounds gruesome, but the faster the death is, the more humane. A glue trap is not a fast death. It's a slow starvation and a terrifying thing. And there's, I don't see any reason why that anybody would find that a preferable way to kill an animal. They can get, you know, they get, sometimes their snout gets caught and they suffocate. And those are, in fact, you know, the lucky ones, because it's over more quickly than, you know, they may try to kind of gnaw off their limb because they're trying to get away. And it's just slow and kind of agonizing and awful. So, and I know there's countries in Europe and elsewhere in the world where they're not legal. I mean, of course, people get on the internet and get anything on the internet.
Yeah, so ethics and dealing with animals, it becomes a driving concern whenever we have when nature breaks the law, and of course, you know, animals are just following their instinct. It's humans that actually have greater agency and are able to adapt their behavior. And so is the focus really on how people can be educated and provided the management tools to live in a more harmonious, harmony with these animals?
Well, sure. I mean, my books are often just, it's me spending a couple years wandering through a world that I didn't know existed. And in this case, human wildlife conflict. And what was so interesting to me is just how complicated it is. Anytime someone says, well, why don't you just do this? That person isn't really living inside that conflict. It's just not, it's never straightforward. It's really interesting, not straightforward. For example, I spent some time in Aspen where there are a lot of bears. It's bear country. You know, it's a ski resort town. We're up in the mountains and it's terrain that is very amenable for bears. And so there's been laws passed, you know, you must have a bear resistant garbage container. If you're a restaurant, you need to have a locking bear resistant dumpster for food scraps. You'd think that, you
what
know, that
makes
would
it bear
take
resistant?
It. Oh, it's a two-step locking process. And in other words, you can't man, and it's reinforced. So you can't, you know, bears like jump on a container and pop it open. They get their claws wedged in. It's pretty hard to create a container that a bear cannot get into. I mean, there was an epidemic of bears breaking into minivans and other cars in Yosemite, and they can do it fast, man. They are really good.
They know how to do a door handle. I've seen them just pop a door handle.
Yeah, exactly. So that's, they're made and they are tested against bears. So they're these things work pretty well, but they don't work as well all the time if people forget to lock them. So you have, plus you have to enforce, you have a law saying everybody has to use these dumpsters. Well, who's gonna have the personnel to go around and write the tickets? Who's gonna enforce it? Who's gonna collect the fines? And also, you have three or four restaurants using one dumpster. How do you prove who left it open, and how do you prove that? Who gets the fine? So also, these containers sometimes don't fit the trucks that come to pick up the garbage bins. So the waste management people don't like it. Are they going to retrofit their trucks, and who's going to pay for that? And also in a place like Aspen, a lot of these are vacation rentals. People use Airbnb for part of the year. So people are coming in from out of town. They don't know about bears. They don't know the consequences of bears getting used to eating garbage. So they don't necessarily follow the instructions they've been given, or they don't care. So it's just a big stinking mess. It should be pretty straightforward, but you're dealing with humans.
So the concern is that bears will become more accustomed to people eating their garbage, and this will also grow the population of bears. But we want these animals to see us as someone not to interact with.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Wild animals typically are wary of humans, and when they start to lose that wariness, that shyness, they get bolder. Eventually, the boldness becomes aggression. And if an animal sees that you've got something really tasty and it wants it, it's gonna come into your dining room sometimes, or it's gonna break into your cabin. And if your home, say you have a dog, the dog barks at the bear gets defensive, then you try to intervene. And that's how people get hurt or killed. So it's just not a good scenario when people and wild animals are kind of too close. It's fine, they're passing through your yard, that's great. They're beautiful to see, but encouraging them with food, once that starts to happen, you're setting up a scenario that unfortunately usually ends with the bear being put down because it's considered a threat to public safety. So, and that's really, it's very sad.
Do bears, they attack people like we talked about the cougar? Are they interested in eating people?
No, bears are, they're omnivores. They do eat, they'll eat fish, they eat insects, but mostly lots of acorns and crab apples and nuts and berries, grasses. They're equipped for that. Their teeth are, they've got molars for grinding. We're not on the menu.
Okay, but sometimes we're in conflict, and that conflict can get dangerous, if not lethal.
That's right.
All right, we're taking another break. We're going to continue our conversation with Mary Roach. She is known as the Weird Science Writer. We'll find out more why that is when we come back. Her latest book is Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. If you have a question, call in. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you've had a wild close encounter with a wild animal, tell us. We'd love to hear about that. And the number again, 833-TPR-TALK. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking with Mary Roach, science writer, author of 6 best-selling books. Her latest release is Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. More than 500 people were killed by animals in Texas between 1999 and 2019, making the state the most for such deaths. And this is after California. California is number 2. They had 299 deaths. Texas, dogs, mountain lions, snakes, they were some of the animals that have caused human deaths over the last 2 decades. So, Mary Roach, what kind of precautions do you take when you go out on a nature walk?
Oh, none. I don't do anything at all. I would love to see mountain lion, you know, it's so rare to see. Obviously, I don't want to see one of those ears flat, like crouching, about to jump on me. But that's so uncommon that I don't really give it a thought when I head out. But I love seeing snakes, foxes, bobcats. I'm trying to think of the things that we see while hiking out here. So I think it's smart to have bear spray if you're up in, you know, if you're up in like Michigan or the boundary waters or so, you know, somewhere where it's heavy bear population. That makes sense. I don't actually, when I'm backpacking in the Sierras, we always we put our food and anything that smells delicious, even like shampoo, whatever, in a bag with a rock on the, throw the rock over the branch and hoist it up out of the way of bears so they can't get to it. Because that, you know, those are the cases you hear about. Somebody has food in their tent. So the bear's trying to get into the tent. The person wakes up, there's a, and somebody gets hurt or killed. So very, very careful about that backpacking. But just out on a hike, I don't do anything.
All right, let's go to a caller, Anya. And Anya, you're on the air. Anya, go ahead.
Hi. So I actually work in San Antonio, Texas, for wildlife services, and I do a lot of wildlife damage management work. And there are a lot of studies, and there was a lot that were discussed at the last Wildlife Society meeting about how coyotes particularly and foxes are actually do a lot better in urban environments because a lot of them are pushed out of wild environments, and it's easier for them to find food in urban environments. And a lot of what I deal with is, the coyotes that take, sheep or any livestock, then I have to go out there and trap and snare for them and get rid of them. So I'm just curious what your recommendations are. I mean, I know what my recommendations are through my work. It's to try and do an assessment at each individual place. But I think that we really need to get the public knowing that this is a really big issue, and that if you have property, you need to make sure your fence line is secure, and you need to ensure that you have cages for all your animals. And I did work out in Florida too, and it's the same for when you have panthers out there. So,
Anna, do you do relocate the coyotes?
It depends on what I get in my live traps. I have a couple snare traps out at the moment. But if they get snared, then unfortunately, I don't relocate. Some of my live traps that I trap for feral dogs that go onto the airfield that I'm working on currently, I will relocate those. And I got a skunk a couple times, but I've actually never had a coyote get in a live trap. They're a little bit trap shy because of how long people have been working on this airfield in particular. So more than likely you just snare drop them and then pretty quick death. Yep, that's it.
Anya, thank you for the call. Mary Roach.
Sure, yeah. Thank you, Anya. Great to hear that. I spent a fair amount of time with folks from Wildlife Services and the National Wildlife Research Center, which is the research arm. And one of the things that I was happy to hear about is that Wildlife Services, well, first of all, I should say, yeah, that the first thing that most of the folks I talk to about when people call in saying, my chickens are getting killed by this fox or whatever, they give advice like, well, here's some ways you could make a nighttime enclosure for your animal, whether it's a goat or a chicken or whatever it is you have in your backyard farm area. Here's how to make a more secure nighttime enclosure. You know, we're talking about preventive measures. So in terms of mountain lions, keep the brush cleared back so there's not a way for them to sneak up. One thing that's been happening that I've been hearing about is that they're looking to increase the funding for people at Wildlife Services who specifically focus on non-lethal approaches and not just giving advice, but also, like helping, like doing range riding. So, helping out with, if you have a flock that's with their, depredations by coyotes or wolves. So more of a focus on preventing these things and dealing with them in a humane way. So thank you for calling in, Anya. It's great that, you do that work and that you do try to steer people towards ways to prevent the problem from happening more rather than going straight to killing the predator.
Okay, let's go to Joe. The number is 833-TPR-TALK if you want to call in and talk with Mary Roach. And Joe is on the line. Joe, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I do a lot of running, and I actually do a lot of like trail running, and have been out on various trails and the Greenway here as well. And I never really encountered any wild animals, but interestingly enough, I was running in my neighborhood, and out of nowhere, this like pack of dogs, and I call it a pack, there were like three or four, maybe five, I don't remember now, came out of nowhere, and they all kind of surrounded me, and I'm like, what is going on? So I was like, I'm backing away, like I didn't want to turn my back on him, and I didn't want to run. So I'm raising my arms, trying to like yell or something, and like not running, but like just walking away. And I was curious to kind of hear your take on that. Like, aside from the leash law ordinance that's being broken, obviously, like what was going on there? Why did the dogs do that?
All right, Joe, thank you for that. So Mary Roach, these dogs reverting back to their feral selves?
Wow, that is something I haven't heard about. Dogs in packs. You do hear that. I've heard about that in some countries where there are really large numbers of stray and feral.
Let me just say that San Antonio has a lot of stray dogs, and I've had that exact same experience that Joe has had.
Oh, wow. Well, it sounds like you did the right thing in not running away. I mean, I know there are, well, certainly with a mountain lion, if you are in a situation where you're suddenly face to face with a mountain lion that's intent on, you know, focused on you in kind of a threatening way, the last thing you should do is run away, because that triggers this predator prey response where it just chases and it's like it's in attack mode now. So running away or mountain biking away from a predator like that is the wrong thing to do. So it's good that it sounds like what you did was the right thing to do, but I didn't talk to anybody about dogs. It's mostly wild animals, although these dogs do sound like they've become wild. And wow, that's, huh, what is it about San Antonio?
Good question. So I got this press release in my inbox just before we were getting ready to go on the air. I want to ask you about this. It's a company here in Texas called Colossal. They just announced that they're going to begin a process to bring back woolly mammoths. And they say they have some breakthrough technology. They're going to use CRISPR and all these other things to de-extinction woolly mammoths. And what do you think of that?
Oh, I am very conflicted about that. On the one hand, how awesome would it be to see a woolly mammoth? I can't think of anything cooler than encountering a live woolly mammoth. But the other side of that, I think from the perspective of, you know, the, you know, is that a, well, humane thing to do, to bring this animal back when it's the only one? And it's, I don't know what, and what is that, what, how, you know, you're inserting into our current diversity load this, and I'm just speaking knowing really nothing about this project, but it does seem like anytime you kind of dump a species into an existing ecosystem, there's going to be some either environmental consequences or consequences for the other species that are not optimal. So yeah,
like,
I don't know
like
if they're talking
like New Zealand with the rabbits.
Yeah, right, exactly. When you bring in one species to kill another, and it turns out, oh, actually, they're more interested in those little flightless birds.
Right, they brought in weasels to control the rabbits, and then the weasels said, hey, there's a whole lot of stuff here to eat.
These eggs are pretty tasty. Yeah, so bringing, and I don't know if they're talking about just an just to see if you, proof of concept, let's do one woolly mammoth, or they're talking about introducing
them. No, they're talking about bringing them back. So it's just interesting because, you know, a woolly mammoth had a very complex social structure, and bringing them back without having to have that institutional herd knowledge, I wonder how that would work.
Well, and also, I mean, just from what I know about elephants in the north of India, where there's just not enough room for the, I mean, they're used to moving along this elephant corridor, it's called, and that's been broken up a lot by, you know, military installations that have been built, roadways going through populations of refugees. There's not enough space for them. And when there's not enough space for elephants, they're going to come through your village and they can cause a lot of damage and people get upset and people get killed. 500 people a year are killed by elephants in India. And if they weren't coming into contact with people, there wouldn't be 500 people killed. So now we're talking about bringing woolly mammoths back. I'm assuming Siberia, somewhere where there'd be a lot of room for them. I don't know. It's a very interesting idea, but I would think carefully.
Science writer Mary Roach will continue with us for the top of the hour, and we welcome your questions and comments. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. She's written about all sorts of things, about going to Mars, sex in space, gulp about your intestines, mainly about flatulence, grunt to curious science of humans at war, spook science tackles the afterlife, stiff the curious lives of human cadavers. If you read those books, got questions and comments, give us a call. They were bestsellers. They're great books. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me is Mary Roach. Her new book comes out tomorrow, Fuzz. And we're talking about what happens when animals break the law, when nature breaks the law. Let's go to Nikita on the phones. It's 833-TPR-TALK. Nikita, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, love your show.
Thank you.
Just wanted to make a comment. We have a real big problem going back to the feral dogs, packs of dogs here in San Antonio. It seems like it's very connected to the lack of spay and neuter, even though we have great organizations like SNAP out there. But I was wondering what she thinks about the fact that places like San Antonio have such large populations of these feral domesticated animals. Do you think that could be a dangerous situation for zoonotic disease in the future? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, Nikita, thank you for the call. Mary Roach.
I think spay and neuter efforts are the answer for sure. I don't know about the zoonotics. I didn't get into that in the book. I mean, obviously with feral dogs, you know, there's rabies is a concern, but beyond that, I really can't comment. But yeah, that's interesting. I didn't realize San Antonio had that issue. And is there a spay and neuter
There's major efforts all the time we talk about them here on the program. It's just a situation here. San Antonio has so many dogs that we actually, we will export them to other cities that don't have enough dogs for adoption. And that's a successful program.
Wow. It's interesting that how did that come about? Just
through Pets Alive and volunteers and pilots who have decided that they will help fly those dogs. I've gone on that journey and reported on that, and they fly them to Boise, and people line up to adopt them.
It's interesting because when I was in New Delhi and I was reporting on that, they have quite a problem with urban monkeys, macaques, which get into a lot of mischief and sometimes people get injured. And the guy I was speaking to is the head of the veterinary unit, the city government's animal guy. And he said, because I was asking him about the problems he has with monkeys, and he said, I hear that in American cities, stray dogs are a huge problem. And I looked at him like, what? I bet he was stuck. I bet he had read something about, maybe he heard your one of your reports.
Right. So those macaques, they're trying birth control on those macaques.
And that's a tough one with a free ranging population, because the options that you have are an oral contraceptive or a shot. In other words, an immunovaccine. So that works against the reproductive system. But in the case of an oral bait, you know, how do you keep the wrong animals from eating it? You know, you put it out and you want the monkeys to eat it, but you don't want the animals that you don't want to affect the population. You don't want them eating it. And also, how do you regulate which individuals, the dosing, you know, how does it you keep one monkey from scarfing at all? I mean, and plus they're roaming all over. So, immunocontraceptive vaccine shots would require a booster. At this point, there's not a one-shot deal. So how that you've got to mark them so you know who's had the first shot, and then get the. It's almost like doing the you know COVID vaccine here. You got to make sure they're going to come back for the second shot. Well, how do you do that with a free ranging group of monkeys? So tends to be useful more on like an isolated population. Like
do they shoot horses. Do they shoot them with a dart or something?
You can do that. That people have done that here with a sort of self-injecting dart.
Now, maybe we can do that with the COVID vaccine here.
Yeah, good luck with that.
We do that. There are some states, so that's the only place it'll take. So let me ask you about how climate change is impacting the way that we interact with the natural world. We've seen in the West during the mega drought, we saw wild horses going into neighborhoods that they typically would not. There's a lack of water, and it's changing the landscape.
Yes. So here in California, we're in a drought situation, and I was just speaking to somebody at California Fish and Wildlife, and saying that the calls that they get about wildlife coming into people's backyards, it usually escalates later in the summer when things are drier, and it's been drier for a while. So they're getting those calls earlier, he said. So you are definitely seeing that. And also with the wildfires, the animals trying to find food where they can. The other thing that was interesting, I learned from a researcher in Colorado, he said that as temperatures rise, the hibernation period for bears gets shorter. So for every approximately 2 degrees Fahrenheit increase in temperature, the hibernation is about a week shorter. So projecting that out to 2050, according to this study, hibernation would be between 15 and 40 days shorter. And that's 15 to 40 days more where bears are out on the land looking for food, interacting with people. And so we're going to, likely be seeing more conflicts as this goes on.
So we're talking about nature breaking the law. And one law that they don't really respect at all is jaywalking. We see a lot of creatures, deer, moose, you name it, go out onto the roads. It can even be, squirrels. And they don't do very well when they come head to head with the F-150.
No, they don't. It's interesting. Animals have, particularly prey animals, they are very good at judging, how close can I let this predator come to me before I flee? It's called flight initiation distance. And they're very good at tracking that with animals that they've evolved with. But when you bring an F-150 into the scenario, they didn't evolve with trucks. So, and those trucks go fast, there's no predator that goes 60 miles an hour or 80 miles an hour. And so they are not as good at calculating, when do I need to get out of the way?
So is that the deer in the headlights thing?
Yeah, the deer in the headlights, that the nighttime complicates it because you have these little pinpoints of light and they don't appear, when the truck comes closer, it's hard to tell that it's coming closer because you don't see the truck looming. You don't see it getting bigger and bigger. So the deer stands there going, huh, a couple of spots of light. What is that? What? Boom. So it's tough for them. So there's actually a National Wildlife Research Center has invested some money into this. It's a light bar that would illuminate the front of the vehicle, the grill. So now an animal could see that that's getting bigger and bigger. And it is in fact coming towards them and they need to get out of the way. So that has been shown to help. And that is something, I think they've got a patent, but it's not on the market.
What about those devices that are supposed to emit a sound like that only these animals can hear and will scare them away?
Whenever they're put to the test, they seem not to work very well. They put out a sound it's pretty tough to even those blink, there's motion triggered deer danger, deer crossing, which is better than just a stationary sign, a metal sign. If you can make it motion triggered so that people take it more seriously. The problem is a lot of times, it's like plants blowing in the wind or a car pulled over. So there's so many false positives with those that people kind of go, I don't believe you. There's nothing in the road. So it's
so like the deer don't believe the sign that says this is a traffic, there's cars coming. So how can we get better at this, at you know, living with these creatures, having harmony?
Oh, just the trick is to outsmart them, to be creative, like the, you know, the light bar, you know, so just getting to better understand their behavior, why they're doing what they're doing, and how you might influence that behavior. So educating yourself in the ways of that animal, for example, you know, understanding, you know, what's going on with a deer in the headlights and how could we solve that? You know, what would be a better way to, you know, how could we outfit our cars and trucks so that to help the deer to get out of the way? So just educating ourselves and then trying to think creatively about what might be a good solution.
Are scarecrows getting better?
Yeah, scarecrows. Well, there's a laser scarecrow now that I got to see in action. Scarecrows are so, yeah, I love this, that apparently scarecrows, the kind that's just, you know, some hay stuffed inside a shirt with a hat, birds quickly figure out, okay, that's not a threat. They call your bluff. They're like, that thing isn't doing anything. And they even, scarecrows become kind of like a McDonald's sign on the side of the road. It's like, oh, hey, just, you know, we're migrating overhead, but look, there's a scarecrow. There must be some good food there.
But put
there.
Some lasers in there. Now yeah. You got something.
Put some lasers in there, yeah.
And so this is something we can use not just for crows, but for other animals as well, in order to keep them out of areas where they're in trouble, maybe even runways, so we don't have bird strikes?
Well, lasers are used, mostly they've been used with birds. They're a little tricky on air strips and tarmacs. You know, you don't want the laser to blind the pilot. So lasers in airports are kind of a tricky combination. But lasers, depends on the species, depends on whether it's nighttime or daytime, depends on the color of the laser and the wavelength. There are so many papers out there now. It does seem to hold some promise in discouraging birds from roosting in places where they shouldn't be roosting or where they're not wanted. So that, you know, you can discourage them from showing up in large numbers. So little hope there that might work, hopefully not damaging to the eyes. That's another thing they're looking at right now, is do the lasers in some way harm the bird's eyes?
Mary Roach, science writer, a very popular science writer, author of six best-selling books, now seven, with the latest release, Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. Mary Roach, it was great talking with you.
Oh, I loved it. Thank you so much, David.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by Jackie Velez and Xiaowen Chen. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.